This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
College and university campuses have been the birthplace of a lot of American ideas, good and bad, benign and controversial. But today, a lot of speakers are being prevented from talking about those ideas on campus, and students are one of the main culprits.
Increasingly, students were using these kind of faulty, medicalized reasons for justifying censorship.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, a First Amendment expert talks about the coddling of American minds on campus. Then we'll hear from a mental health professional and 9/11 survivor about the damage that can come from making political points from terror attacks. And we'll spend an academic minute losing weight and keeping it off by eating. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. First Amendment expert Greg Lukianoff thinks something's been going wrong on many college campuses in the last few years. Speakers are being shouted down. Professors say they're walking on eggshells, eliminating controversial material from syllabi. Rates of anxiety, depression, and suicide are rising on campus as well as nationally. So how did this happen? Lukianoff and his co-author, social psychologist Jonathan Haidt, looks at this cultural shift to explain the background behind the crisis in academia and offer some solutions in the new book called The Coddling of the American Mind, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue spoke with Greg Lukianoff and asked how he and his co-author took on this topic.
Well, it was interesting. I've been working on campuses defending free speech and academic freedom since about 2001, and I became friends with John partially because we have this kind of weird position in the culture wars. You know, I'm a political liberal, but I defend people from all over the spectrum. He tries to get liberals and conservatives to better understand where they're coming from. So we had become friends before noticing this trend on campus. But around 2013, 2014, almost seemingly overnight, we went from the students being the absolute best constituency on campus for free speech, and that includes offensive speech, that includes controversial speech on campus, to being the ones that were demanding everything from new speech codes to disinvitations to safe spaces and microaggression policies, for example. And we were really wondering where this came from. So we ended up writing an article in 2015 talking about how increasingly students were using these kind of faulty medicalized reasons for justifying censorship. And we, in our original article, we tried to point out how potentially detrimental some of the thinking could actually be for mental health outcomes. And we wrote the book partially because when the data came in, it was way, way worse than we thought it was going to be.
So give me a sense of the range of the problem, meaning, are we seeing this on Ivy League campuses? Are we seeing this on state college campuses? Or are we seeing this across the board? Is this really having an impact in all halls of academia?
Well, the problems are very different depending on what kind of campus you're talking about. Now, definitely when it comes to the students themselves demanding everything from disinvitations to new speech codes, we're seeing that more concentrated in the more elite campuses. And we do think that that's partially at least the product of some of the sort of upper class parenting problems that we see.
Nicely
put.
When
you look on more... Well, you know, we actually, two chapters we have on parenting are two of my favorite, and we think it's everything from overscheduling to even something as simple as lack of free play, that you are actually seeing really bad mental health outcomes for a lot of the kids that are coming in to college as freshmen. And we think part of this is that students are unwittingly disempowering their own students, creating a lack of locus of control, the psychological term, that is one of the reasons why we see these increases in anxiety and depression.
So obviously I want to talk to you about some of the solutions that you talk about in the book, but how did we get here? What mm-hmm. brought us here, do you think?
What we call it is we call these problems of progress in the book. We actually think that all things being equal, these are probably predictable but good problems to have. That essentially when we can spend more time with our kids, we do. When we can be more protective of our kids, we are, unless someone actually points out that, by the way, there's a danger in taking it too far. We think that, you know, social media, we see actually as in many ways like a technological heaven if you looked at it from the point of view of 1970. But of course, as we now know, one of the downsides of this massive communication revolution is that we can form ourselves into echo chambers. You know, Facebook and Twitter both pat us on the back essentially for being in echo chambers, and that's negative. But the scariest thing is we also see a strong correlation between how much teenagers use social media and outcomes as severe as suicide.
When you think about the problem, and this is interesting because you don't blame the students. You say
no.
They're under enormous pressure to perform, and nor do you think that the problems that are facing these kids are all in their heads. So where do you go with that?
Mm-hmm. At the end of the book, we try to offer as many solutions as possible. But the first thing we have to say is we want to hear from readers about different ideas. We thought of this as the beginning of a discussion. We're just trying to diagnose the problem. But everything from things as simple as, you know, having associations of parents who get together to allow more independence for their children, you know, to allow for things like free play and unstructured time could go a long way. We think gap years can help a lot. That can help give students that sense of sort of independence and autonomy that in some cases they come into school lacking, due partially in some cases to helicopter parenting. But we also think universities themselves can do a much better job of preparing students for the fact that when done correctly, an education is going to be, it's at times, emotionally and cognitively difficult, that it's going to be challenging. And I think that sometimes people tend to throw up their hands like there's nothing that could be done for higher education, when my argument is we've barely even started.
You mentioned that two of your favorite chapters in the book are those on parenting, and I'm interested because they're fascinating chapters. When it comes to the parents and their responsibilities and their role in this, what did you find?
Well, we went and talked to three different parenting experts. Erica Christakis, who's the author of a book called The Importance of Being Little, Julie Lithcott-Haynes, who wrote a book called How to Raise an Adult, and the famous free-range mom herself, Lenore Skenazy. And all of them said parents are in a very well-intentioned effort to help and nurture their kids, and we're mostly talking about more sort of like elite college-bound type students. They're overscheduling them, and they're eliminating free time and play. And one thing that was really amazing to me while researching this, I mean, I'm a lawyer with a deep interest in psychology, but I didn't realize how strong the research was when it came to unstructured time. I have two kids under three myself, and I look at the way my friends are actually raising their children. They're scheduled from 6 a.m. to when they go to bed at night.
Right.
And realizing that this actually goes against what the research actually says really conclusively was kind of a shock even to me.
And that doesn't end, right? I mean, your kids are three, but I don't have children, but I have nieces and nephews who range in age anywhere from 12 to soon to be 18. So I see this swath, but they don't have any time. They get up in the morning, they've got practice before school, and then after they're,
yep.
You know, you're lucky if you catch them before 11 o'clock at night. And it just seems to me that once you release them into college,
yep.
And there is more unstructured time, well, God knows what's going to happen.
Yeah, and that's why you have to give it earlier. And that's one of the reasons why we recommend things like gap years. But of course, the worst kind of gap year would be essentially just a continuation of the helicopter sort of over-parenting additional year. The goal of parents has to be to cultivate independence and a sense of autonomy. There's a wonderful book that I didn't get to include a mention of called Achtung Baby, about how German society, particularly in the wake of totalitarianism, had a real commitment to free time for kids and to raise independently minded children, even though parents themselves found this difficult. And in a funny way, we should actually be looking to Germany in some ways to teach us to raise kids who are ready for life as free people.
It's interesting because you just made a great point in the sense that you don't want that gap year just to be an extension of what it already is. But what it already is seems to be that structured time. Like when I was a kid, I don't know how old you are, but when I was a kid, mm-hmm. It was school first, and then, you know, 15, 16, you start to get a part-time job. But that doesn't mm-hmm. even seem to be the kids that I see now, some, but not all. The work component isn't as important as the either, you know, what looks good on the college application or
yeah.
the sports or whatever else may be going on.
Yeah. And this brings us to, you know, one of the reasons why we hate these really mocking terms like snowflake, for example. Like, these things are insulting to these younger people.
Oh, I'm proud of it.
Who don't really have it easy. Like, in a lot of cases, these students are sort of pointed like rockets, you know, towards the for the Princetons and the Stanfords and the Harvards, treated like they have to be Yo-Yo Ma by the time.
Well, right. Yes.
By the time they're 17, so you end up having these people who they might be extremely good at academic habits, but when it comes to the intellectual habits that let you be, you know, a fully functioning adult, they haven't had time or space to cultivate that. So in a lot of ways, none of this will work unless parents actually start to understand that some of these things that, where we had to figure out our problems on our own, were essential. They weren't side efforts in our lives. They were actually essential to make us happy and functioning adults.
So what is the responsibility, if we take a step back, what is the responsibility of schools? What is the responsibility of high schools, grade schools, in, for want of a better term, helping parents get through this?
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that we repeat over and over again is that we have to stop teaching sort of the mental habits of anxious and depressed people and then being surprised when students are anxious and depressed. A big inspiration for the book and our way of looking at it is cognitive behavioral therapy. And it's one of the most successful interventions for anxiety and depression, but where you look at your own sort of exaggerated thoughts. You look at your catastrophizing, for example, when something small happens and you just assume it's the end of the world. And everybody does this, but anxious and depressed people have more cognitive distortions, and the way to fight them is to fight back against them. But how this applies to parenting is, don't raise your kids like they're in constant danger. Don't raise their kids like as if getting, you know, a C will mean the end of the world. And you have to come together with your community to actually create an environment that allows kids to experiment, to fail, and to have a more realistic approximation of how things are not constantly threatening.
Again, the name of Greg Lukianoff's new book is The Coddling of the American Mind: How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas Are Setting Up a Generation for Failure. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue. Still to come, can a political ad have an effect on our mental health? That's next on the best of our knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. After the 9/11 attacks, James Halpern led the first team of mental health workers at Ground Zero. The founding director of the Institute for Disaster Mental Health at the State University of New York in New Paltz says he was offended by a political ad that attacks Antonio Delgado. He's the Democratic candidate in New York's 19th congressional district. The ad, which is paid for by Paul Ryan's Super PAC, shows a quick image of the burning Twin Towers. Halpern says the context in which the image is shown dishonors the memory of the civilians and first responders who were lost on that day. The Best of Our Knowledge's Allison Dunn spoke with Halpern about that ad and its effect on students and adults. A warning, some listeners may find the descriptions in this story unsettling.
Sometimes I worry that the attacks on 9/11 were more impactful and more effective than people realize. I think we all know that 3,000 people died on that day, but sometimes people forget that there were tens of thousands of men and women who worked through the recovery process, recovering body parts, tens of thousands of body parts, and it may take decades before we know the full extent of all of the physical and emotional trauma. World Trade Center Health Program is now treating 42,000 with certified health conditions, 6,000, 9,000 with cancer, and I'm one of those survivors. But people also I think, can forget that terrorism is psychological warfare, and it's a style of political violence intended to assault safety, security, cohesion, and intended to create divisions and scapegoats and xenophobia. And we, I think, could all agree that we're seeing more of that in our country right now. So that particular ad that's put out by the Congressional Leadership Fund spends hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of dollars to attack Antonio Delgado as anti-American, and politicizes all of us victims of 9/11 with the burning Twin Towers in our state, where thousands of people died. And because I was so close to all of those events and so close to so many people who got sick, people who perished, family members, and so forth, I think that that event is minimized by people who seek to use the deaths of innocent people for their political agenda. So it doesn't just, I'm sure it offends Delgado, but it offends victims and survivors as well. And I would hope that Congressman Faso would denounce the ad and call for its removal. It is highly offensive.
The ad is from the Congressional Leadership Fund Political Action Committee. The Faso campaign declined to comment, citing federal law that does not permit coordination with super PACs, including commenting on ads. A spokesperson for the super PAC did not respond in time for this broadcast. Now, I know you support Antonio Delgado, but I'm assuming this ad would be offensive to you no matter who put it out.
Absolutely. I think that, again, disasters can be used to score political points in various directions. I remember so well in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 how we unified as a country, and the right and left came together as we went to Ground Zero down the West Side Highway to do the work that we were doing. There were people cheering all of us. It seemed very clear to me that there were people of all political stripes, all ethnic groups, races, and religions supporting that recovery effort. And very disheartening to see that an ad like that would divide us.
It's obvious what the ad is doing for you and that it prompted you to speak out, but what do you think it's doing for the families and loved ones of victims of 9/11?
Well, that, I think, is my primary concern. I think that seeing those burning towers in that way certainly could be a trigger. It could certainly inspire hate. It could certainly inspire scapegoating and xenophobia, and could create lots of reminders and problems and triggers for them.
The image of the burning towers in the ad is quite brief, but, says Halper, notable.
And there is a way in which it's placed, I think, in a very sophisticated way to tie the candidate to terrorism, and seems so offensive in that way. And again, I think it's my own personal response from being there and being with survivors and victims. There were so few bodies that were intact on that day. So it's so powerful and so poignant that just the brief scene of the Twin Towers burning is very evocative for us who were close to it.
Halpern describes his work when leading the first team of mental health workers at Ground Zero.
I worked at Ground Zero for several days. I focused my work on managing the missing persons hotline that first week, because that was the point of contact when survivors were looking for lost loved ones. They were calling into that hotline, and I was training call takers and call responders. I also escorted FDNY families to the site so they could see where their loved one perished. I worked at respite centers, family assistance centers, assisted when people returned to Battery Park City, and assisted at the various memorials for 10 or 15 years after the event.
Halpern says the field of disaster mental health has grown since 9/11.
It was a very early field on 9/11. It was really only the beginning of disaster mental health. And it was really out of that that the Institute developed and grew. It's now under the very strong leadership of Dr. Amy Nitsa. We know better how to help people who are traumatized by catastrophic events. There's pretty clear understanding of the principles that should underlie those helping behaviors, making sure that we can do all we can to promote safety and help people to feel safe and be safe and keep them calm, help them understand that they have some agency, that they can support themselves, helping them to take advantage of their connections to family and friends and clergy and others, helping them to promote hope. These principles were often carried out on 9/11, but it wasn't so widely understood. And we now have a much better trained group of professionals to provide support to disaster survivors, and we're certainly going to need them.
James Halpern is founding director of the Institute for Disaster Mental Health at SUNY New Paltz. Reporting for the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Allison Dunn.
So you've lost some weight. Good for you. You want to keep it off? Start eating. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Eating can be a tool to help keep weight off. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Bodil Just Christensen, postdoctoral fellow at the University of Copenhagen, explains why how you think about eating food can help you stay thin.
The hardest thing about weight loss is to maintain it. My colleagues and I carried out a study that shows that strict rules are the key to weight maintenance. We saw that people who were good at keeping weight off after losing it didn't eat to accommodate desire, hunger, or satiety. Instead, they considered eating as a tool with a higher purpose, and they devised their own systems for what, how much, and when to eat. These choices were not guided by hunger, but by the singular aim of keeping the weight off. In our study, we investigated the effect of appetite hormones on weight maintenance. 42 participants lost weight on a powder diet, and then they were encouraged to maintain the weight loss during the next year. Those who succeeded after 12 months created systematic routines that fit into their daily lives. They structured their own systematic rules for eating and stuck to them regardless of feelings of hunger and satiety. They made practical rules for themselves. For example, that they should eat a small meal every 3 hours, or that main meals must never exceed 500 calories, or that they were only allowed to eat chocolate on Saturdays and no more than 30 grams. What mattered most was that they followed these systematic habits precisely. This approach minimizes the number of choices in relation to when, what, and how much they can eat. As a result, the risk of caving in goes down radically. Another important finding is that lack of social support, high levels of obligations and stress caused participants to regain lost weight as it hampered the establishment of systematic eating routines.
That was Bodil Just Christensen of the University of Copenhagen. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.